We get things rolling this afternoon by welcoming to the show the author of a wonderful new book entitled Wild Nights, How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. It's written by Benjamin Reese, a professor of English at Emory University and the author of The Showman and the Slave and Theaters of Madness. Ben, thanks for being with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me on your program.
And how do you sleep? That's what I'd like to know.
You know, it comes and goes with me, like it does for a lot of people. Definitely raising kids was a bit of a challenge in terms of trying to get myself on a schedule that worked for me. And you know, times of high stress and a lot of obligations at work, I have trouble wrapping my sleep around that. But when I have more open space, I sleep great.
So what inspired you to do this really wonderful study of the history of sleep and what we've done to it in modern times?
Well, sleep is weird. I mean, and I'm attracted to weirdness. It's this little place in our lives that we go every single night, and we're not there. And we can't report on it. We don't know what's happening. And it seems like it's just a part of life that's just cut off from everything else. You know, history stops when people go to bed. But in another way, really, it doesn't stop. And sleep is a part of human history. And I wanted to get a sense of how does it fit in with the rest of life as we've built it during our waking hours. And as I began to dig with it, I found that a lot changes about sleep over time, and there's a lot of variation across cultures and historical periods in the way people sleep and what they think about it.
And certainly the notion is a very modern one of having one block of sleep that would get you through the night, that 8 hours that so many people think is the ideal. That's a relatively new phenomenon in human history.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of these things that we really take for granted about how, you know, what is a good night's sleep, and, you know, what's restful sleep, what's healthy, what's normal, what's natural, things that we're told in sleep hygiene books or by sleep experts or whatever, are that they're the key to sleep. You know, trying to get yourself on a schedule and sleep in an 8-hour block every night, same way every night. Nobody did it that way, apparently, before about the 19th century. It was much more common for people to sleep in different installments, either in kind of two chunks at night. That was really a common way for people to sleep in Europe and North America before the 19th century, and they would have like an hour in between. And there were all sorts of interesting activities that happened during that hour. There were dream interpretation, prayer. It was thought to be a time when people were more fertile, so the time for making love and making babies. And you know, and then, of course, there are a lot of cultures that are napping cultures, where in some places, like I was just hearing in Madagascar, some communities, they have two naps during the day, and they can last as long as an hour and a lot less sleep at night. So, you know, the way we're told to do it, to slot it all in one, you know, kind of one envelope at night, is pretty new. A lot of people can't do it.
Well, yeah, and which, as we'll talk about a little later, has led to a whole cottage industry in solving those problems. But in the history of sleep, I was also fascinated to learn that the idea of solitary sleep is also something that's only come along in the last couple of hundred years.
That's right. I mean, almost no families anywhere on the earth could afford the kind of arrangements that we now expect of people to, you know, as being upstanding members of society, where you have parents in one room, and then you have a child sent off to this dark space that's sealed off from everybody else and stay there all the way through the night. Most homes in Europe didn't have bedrooms until around the middle of the 19th century, and the families were a lot larger. So siblings shared beds with each other. Young children often were either in bed or at least in a cradle, you know, right by the parents' bed. Sometimes young children slept with a nurse, even in wealthier families. So kids were not raised to sleep alone. And still, in much of the world, people sleep in much larger groups than the ones that we're told to sleep in. And it seemed to me a very odd expectation for sleep. I mean, first of all, what kid ever wants to do this on their own? You have to train them. You know, you got to get a book, you got to get a system, you got to stick to it, right? And you spend all this time and energy doing it, And then what do you expect when the kid grows up? They're supposed to share a bed with somebody else. And they've never learned to do it. And I think that may be one reason why people have so many sleep complaints. You know, it becomes intolerable to deal with somebody else's snoring or a trip to the bathroom in the middle of the night if you've been trained to sleep in a fortress.
Absolutely. We're talking with Benjamin Reese, author of Wild Nights. And we know a little bit about electric light and what that has done to everyone's schedules and how they were sleep schedules were disrupted when that came along. But I was also fascinated to read about the role of temperature and how in some cultures people for generations went into almost a hibernation-like level of sleep.
Yeah, well, I wonder if, you know, have you been through a blizzard up in Maine the last couple of days?
Yes, we have. Yes.
Yeah, right. So, well, you can think about when people didn't have the didn't have climate control, didn't have electric lights. That when, especially in regions that are far from the equator, when there's very little light available in the wintertime and probably much more scarce food supply, it would make sense for people to reduce their activity in the wintertime and spend more time in bed. You conserve energy. We really don't have as much of a reason to get up and spend time out of bed. So there's a lot of variability according to season in many traditional cultures before they had these modern technologies. But now we're told, you know, the key to healthy sleep is get yourself on a routine, do it the same way every night, and that would be probably a recipe for suicide for people who, you know, really needed to work much longer hours in the summer and then conserve their energy in the wintertime.
Were you surprised to learn that race played a pretty significant role in the development of what we would think of as modern sleep?
Well, there's been a lot of studies recently about what's called a sleep disparity among races. That, you know, if we think about this 7 to 8 hours is the recommended amount of sleep for people, that particularly for African Americans, that recommendation is much harder to follow, that there are more people who are getting far less than 7 hours, or interestingly enough, more people also getting far more than 8 hours. And both of these can actually be tied to health consequences. And so I tried to show in my book the history of that, what led to this disparity. And I traced it back to slavery times, when there really were some kind of shocking attitudes toward what kind of conditions black people could tolerate in sleeping, you know, grouping them together by 10 or 20 on a common floor with no soft bedding. And also a really sort of disturbing history of trying to break slaves by depriving them of sleep. It was really almost a form of torture, and many former slaves wrote about this in their memoirs.
And I see this a lot. I'm a high school teacher, and I often see the effects of this sort of forced schedule that we've imposed on young people. All the research tells us they'd be better off to sleep a little longer and sleep a little later in the day. But we're still in many ways tied to the public school schedules that began back in the 1840s.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's pretty hard to try to recreate any sort of pre-modern sleep conditions in our own lives, because we are so hyper-scheduled. And we've got children on one schedule, parents on another work schedule. And it's getting harder and harder, because work schedules are 9 to 5 is no longer the norm for most, for many adults. Right, it used to be that work schedules and school schedules sort of followed each other, but now with a lot of people doing, you know, work with people in completely different time zones through internet connections or whatever, these things are coming sort of out of sync with each other, and it's very difficult to get everybody on a schedule. I think that's one reason why so many people feel dissatisfied with sleep. It's getting harder and harder to sleep by the rules.
Henry David Thoreau always has a soft place in our hearts up here because of his work, The Maine Woods, but
yeah.
He was a big inspiration to you as well in writing this book.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. As I was starting to study the history of sleep, I'm an English professor, and I taught Walden to my undergrads, and I had read it half a dozen times before, and I had never noticed the whole thing is about sleep and waking, really, it seemed, when you look for it. And he's full, you know, he's really trying to find his own inner rhythm, what later scientists would call circadian rhythms, trying to find the natural clock within him that would be in sync with the passage of day and night and the change in seasons, and to really bring himself into some kind of balance with nature. But when he writes about people in the town and what they're going through, it felt very, very contemporary to me to read his words. He's talking about people being strung out on coffee all the time, and you know, frantic to get to work and to get to the train on time, and losing sleep all over all of these kind of modern distractions and technologies. And there was even one point where he said he had heard of a man who could hardly take a half hour's nap without waking up and demanding to know what the news was. And it felt very, very contemporary to me, like somebody checking their iPhone in the middle of the night. So, you know, I saw Thoreau as being somebody who really witnessed a lot of the changes that sleep went through in the 19th century and gave us the kind of crappy rules for sleep that we've inherited.
And those rules have led those people who find it difficult to conform to investigate things like sleep clinics, some 2,500 of them around the country, a number of sleep disorders that have been identified, and of course a whole pharmaceutical industry geared at helping people sleep. And you don't offer advice so much in the book as just lay out what your research discovered, but it's clear that anybody would be wise to just not take it so seriously if you don't fit what you believe is the expectation of sleep.
Yeah, I think that, for me, that was the key, is trying to get people to see that a lot of what we consider to be sleep troubles aren't necessarily medical issues that you solve with pills or consulting an expert or you know, outfitting yourself with the right gear or gadgetry. And we have, you know, smart beds, we have sleep trackers we can wear on our wrists at night, you know, we have dental devices that help us breathe better. And, you know, these things can really provide relief for a lot of people. But I think it's important to throw into the equation that sleep is a part of our social life. And we make decisions about, and sometimes society makes decisions for us, about how we're supposed to sleep. And maybe it's those expectations that are causing a lot of the troubles as much as anything that's wrong with our bodies.
You talked about having children, and I've got a 3-year-old at home, and I found that going through that for the first time was actually quite liberating, because I realized that for me, I didn't need that block of 6, 7, 8 straight hours a night, that I felt just fine being up for an hour in the middle of the night and going back to sleep, and I found that in many ways very freeing.
Great. Well, I think a lot of people find it imprisoning. You know, you're suddenly captive to this little creature's rhythms that are, you know, if you've got to get up at 7 in the morning and be fresh for work, and you're up several times in the middle of the night, it's really hard. And I think especially when you have this sense that you're really trying to get the kid on a schedule too, and the kid is resisting it. You know, when my son was little, we used the Ferber technique, which many people do.
Oh, yes.
You go in after 10 minutes, then you let them cry, and then you go another 15 minutes, and you never pick them up, and it's exhausting and it's grueling. And it worked for us, but the problem was he kept getting ear infections, and so we'd have to do the whole thing all over again, and it was really quite brutal. If we had lived in a society where you know, the schedules weren't as rigid, where maybe the children were sleeping with the parents, it wouldn't have been, it still would have been hard, no question. But I think we built in some extra trouble with it that maybe we didn't need to.
And so maybe the best advice would be sleep the sleep that works for you.
I think so. Try to figure out, what are the expectations that you're bringing to sleep, and where do those really come from? Are they coming from your body? Are they coming from scientific understandings of sleep, or are they rules that you've just been led to believe and that maybe haven't always been around?
Benjamin Reese is the author of Wild Nights, How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. It really is a wonderful read. It's been a delight to talk with you this afternoon. We wish you much success with the book and a good night's sleep as well.
Thanks so much for having me. Same to you.
Ben Reese with us here on Downtown.